Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. On the line with me is Tony Gosling from Bristol, England. Welcome back to our program, Tony.
Hi, George. Thanks for inviting me on again.
Man, I'll tell you what, there's a lot going on. Brexit and Venezuela and that poison gas thing again has cropped up. There's just a lot going on. Where do you want to start?
Well, let's start with Brexit because, I mean, I'm actually quite disappointed in a lot of the coverage of this.
Okay.
In the mainstream press, they're kind of putting out the various lines that the various factions want them to put out. They're not really giving a proper critique of Brexit. Let's just put it like this. Brexit is the biggest thing that's happened in Europe for the last 50 years. The idea of it not succeeding, that listen, the oligarchy and the elite work on a ratchet system. Their policies only go one way. It's a little bit like when the mob decides that they're going to appoint a particular governor to a particular state. They are not going to take any... They're not interested in playing by the rules. They're not interested in being sportsmanlike at all. They will just take whatever measures necessary to get their person elected governor. And it doesn't matter what measures they go to do it. And that's what the oligarchy have been doing in Europe for the last 50 years. First of all, with the Treaty of Rome in the late 1940s, and then in the 1950s with the beginnings of the European Union, or when it was actually back in those days, European Community, which Britain joined in the 1970s. And we've now got a situation, it's run on such a long time, that the majority of the population in even the core countries, France and Germany, have had enough of Brussels, they've had enough of EU, and it looks to me as if we have got, they are basically struggling to keep the whole thing together, using bribery, using banks, using the euro currency, and above all, using the mass media in order to try and convince people that the EU is a wonderful thing in order to get the impressionable youth to turn on their elders, the elders of society who've seen the introduction of the European Union, and they've seen the way that the continent has gone, and they've recoiled. And mostly the Brexit vote, let me be absolutely clear, why? Let me just ask you, George, before I say give my opinion. In your opinion, in one word or two words, can you sum up why you think the British people voted for Brexit?
I think they want to regain their independence and their freedoms and not be overwhelmed by the German influence. That's what I think.
Right. I would say close. Yeah, pretty close. The one word is immigration.
Right.
What we've had in Britain is mass migration. A bit like the sort of stuff, I mean, you've been having this obviously with, the Mexican border, et cetera, for many years in the US. And I think to a certain extent, there's no problem with small amounts of migrants coming in. But what's really happened is that the entire working class and the trade unions and the conditions of poor people generally, or poorer people, have been totally undermined by this enormous mass wave of migrants from the developing world. Now, it's not surprising these people want a better life. Of course they do. But for many, many years, those borders have been fairly strong. And it benefits nobody, really, but the oligarchy to have cheap labour. So what they'll have is they'll have all of their smaller people, small businessmen, people like this, know that the way to get ahead in business is to hire all this cheap labour. And none of these cheap labour people tend to be interested, really, in fighting for better paying conditions. They're just looking for the money in order to maybe to send back to the developing world, whether that's Africa, whether it's actually Eastern Europe, which obviously is more developed. But it's the migrant issue which has, I think, really tipped the balance because that was what I think is really annoyed most people. Now, you know, it's not because the migrants are from some other race and the British people are somehow racist, although, of course, some of them are. And they've done everything they possibly can to exploit that angle. It's just a simple fact that the migrants have just undermined the paying conditions of the poorer people in society. And it's meant that effectively what's happened is in the poorer parts of Britain, particularly the industrial north, and the, you know, what are slowly becoming ghetto-like areas in the north of England, where the industries are dying, and there's very little chance of employment, for particularly for young people, that those areas have totally blamed this on migration and the European Union. And they're absolutely right to do it, I think, because the EU has not... There's two massive failings in the EU. One is the financial, and the other is the migrant. And the financial crisis has been deliberately engineered, but I think it's the migrant crisis which has been in people's face. When they see people coming into the UK illegally, taking their jobs and working those jobs for half the pay that they used to get, sometimes it's obviously more than that. But, you know, to take away jobs from people here, that, I think, has been the real reason why there was such a massive vote for Brexit. As for what's going to happen, I mean, my honest guess, is that we will leave on the 29th of March with no deal. And it's quite possible that then, after that, the EU may come back to the table and there may be further negotiations. But there's all sorts of things being talked about here. A second referendum, which is a joke. I mean, it's a bad joke. The idea being that you just keep voting until you get the result that the EU wants you to get. There are lots of Labour MPs particularly parading themselves around in the media saying, oh, Brexit, there's no possibility, we mustn't have a no deal. Well, what they're saying is that we mustn't have a Brexit. We mustn't have what the people voted for, which was to leave the EU. Now, if they can't strike a deal, that's a shame, but it doesn't mean we shouldn't be leaving. But what we've got is the main opposition party that could be making so much of this whole situation have completely caved in. And Labour and Jeremy Corbyn and the rest of them, I think it's largely because, not of Corbyn, but because of his Blairite MPs who are all so wedded, like Tony Blair still is, to the EU. And they're not interested in what the people want. They're just interested in what they themselves want. We had a Conservative MP on the TV this week saying, I cannot believe that so many of these MPs put their own opinions above that of the voters and the people that voted in the referendum, that we are supposed to be the servants of the people. Well, obviously, a lot of politicians aren't like that, but that's what we've been getting here. So that's my best guess, George. I mean, there's all sorts of possibilities. There may be no Brexit. There may be some sort of deal before the 29th, but I think that's the most likely solution on the 29th, is that we leave on a no deal on a World Trade Organization basis. And you know what I think was going to happen then? Well, I said earlier about the business of the ratchet. Yeah, so they only go one way. When the ratchet clicks back, which it's never supposed to do in the oligarchy's minds, they are going to hit us, Jules. They're going to really hit us hard as they possibly can. And that is going to mean like some sort of economic tsunami with literally trillions of pounds being pulled out of the UK by these big investors, and they're going to be putting that into the markets that they control, into the regions that the cartels control, which is the Eurozone. That will be France and Germany. But I don't know if that's going to solve political problems in France and Germany, because in both France and Germany, there's a majority of the general population for Grexit in Germany, or yes. Brexit, or whatever you call it, or Brexit in France. So could, you know, if the economic tsunami comes along, I think we've got to be really, really careful to watch what's happening in the Middle East, because the Israelis are looking for any excuse to start a war down there. They're looking for any excuse to pick a fight with Iran. And we do know that the Israelis are past masters at false flag attacks. So I think we should be really carefully looking around the time of Brexit for anything that happens down there, because that would delight them to use Brexit as a cover for starting some war and also for starting some sort of economic collapse this year. I don't think I'm being alarmist in saying that this spring is possibly the most dangerous time we've had for decades in terms of financial collapse and war, George.
Right. I think you're right on. I noticed there was a hand count down at the World Economic Forum, and they're all for the UK staying in European Union, both of them. Yeah, but you know, but you know who was favoring leaving of all people? Mark Carney.
Well, he's got to say that. I don't think he really believes it at all. He's a creature of the Bank of International Settlements.
Right, right.
Remember, as the governor of the Bank Right. You have to look, that's a difficult job to do.
Right.
I think he's totally the wrong person to do it, because it was him that helped engineer the 2008 financial crisis, him being the Bank for International Settlements. This is the central banker's central bank who does all the banking regulation for the world. He was in charge of the regulation committee for the Bank for International Settlements in the run-up to 2008. So he's responsible for the biggest heist in history. The guy, he really is a criminal. He should never have been made the Bank of England governor. But if you go back to the previous governor, that is to say Mervyn King,
okay,
he was appointed by Gordon Brown when he was Prime Minister, well, actually, no, when he was Chancellor. And King is a completely different character. He's really well worth having a look. Mervyn King, M-E-R-V-Y.
Well, I've watched him and listened to him lately in the last month or so, yeah.
He was a governor of the Bank of England, and my God, he was a lovely guy. And the reason I say that is because he was genuine. We get very few of these. Most of these people are puppets, you know, they're Muppets and puppets. They're just in there for their own personal gain, and basically they're, because they're pliable. But he wasn't. His father was a railway porter up in the north of England, and he was a reasonably poor kid, but he was good at his exams when he was aged 11, and he went to the grammar school in Worcester, to Worcester Grammar School, and he's worked his way up right the way through the financial system to the city to become governor of the Bank of England. And I mean, the thing is that he was making noises before 2008 saying, look, we've got serious problems here. But you see, as governor of the Bank of England, he's got to be very careful what he says. Anything that's construed as political, he could be sacked immediately. And anything that he says which is alarmist could crash the markets. So, you know, you've got to be very careful as governor. And, of course, that's why Mark Carney says absolutely nothing. I mean, even less than Mervyn King did in terms of politics or financial policy. But one thing is, the only thing he is allowed to say is, oh, I support Brexit because this is the will of the British people. He doesn't at all. He's one of the oligarchy who's plotting to undermine the pound when Brexit happens. And that's why he's been kept in there basically as an international agent of the oligarchy. And I hope as soon as Brexit happens, the guy is out on his ear and sent back to Switzerland. There's a kind of a myth that he's from Canada, from the Bank of Canada. Well, he is from the Bank of Canada, but his much more powerful job was at the Bank for International Settlements, the bank that financed the Nazis and was supposed to have been closed down, according to the Bretton Woods Conference after World War II. So Carney, get him out of my hair, man. We don't want him running the Bank of England, because the Bank of England potentially is what we're going to need after Brexit in order to start rebuilding this country again.
Exactly. Yeah, the Bank of England can be a good starter for new businesses and stuff. And that's what UK needs to do, is get back with entrepreneurship and rebuild some of their industries and small businesses. That's for sure. But how about Venezuela? What do you got on that? Have you been watching that some?
Yeah, Venezuela. Well, we had a good discussion on the radio about it last night with Manfred Petrich. He runs the All Smoke and Mirrors blog. He's a former Swiss banker. And Ron Mandel, he's an international relations professor. He's from New York, actually, originally. We had a really good chat about it. Ron came in, I think, with the most interesting comment, though, and that is that this is really the pattern for this kind of coup is Allende, 1973 in Chile, where another individual is set up as the proper president. So that's what they were doing. And even before Allende was chased down, there was a big attempt by Kissinger and the State Department to set up a kind of alternative president. Whether it succeeds, goodness only knows, but I think the Venezuelans have got advice from the Chinese and the Russians about how to persuade the US and Colombia, which, by the way, apparently is a now an associate member of NATO, Colombia. Mm-hmm. Right. So they're right on the doorstep of Venezuela, and they're sandwiched between NATO in Colombia and this new far-right leader in Brazil, which is really scary. They look as if this is going to be their modus operandi in the future. It's going to be trying to grab territory from Venezuela and grab oil. And the U.S. oil companies, you know, Exxon and the rest of them, whatever, they're all really annoyed that the wealth from Venezuela's oil is going to the Venezuelan people. They want it for themselves.
Right. Daniel Estlin came across a clip the other day of a convoy of U.S. embassy SUVs leaving the Venezuelan our embassies over there, and it's up on the web. His book publisher promoter, I think, put it up and told us about it, sent us a copy. But it had it was about
It might sound controversial, George, but I think it's wrong for the Venezuelan government to order out the diplomatic staff of the US because they're not actually at war. I mean, what they've done is, you know, could be construed as an act of war. But, you know, I think it's always a good idea to have some kind of communication.
Right, right, that's for sure.
Unless all everything breaks down. I mean, it's like, for example, Russia and Ukraine. That sort of situation. You know, you need to have some sort of diplomatic lines open still,
right,
you know, in order to continue discussion. The only time that, you know, it's time to go is when it's open hostilities. And we haven't quite got to that stage in Venezuela. But obviously this is sending a signal to the world saying, well, Maduro's had enough. I mean, there's also, of course, that assassination attempt on him using a drone. What we've got here is basic regime change tactics that have been used in the Middle East. It's now coming a little bit closer to home. And the US is thinking, well, maybe if we can't dominate the Middle East, the Middle East, of course, is the great prize. And that the reason for that is because it's the pivot of the three great continents, Africa, Asia, and Europe. And that's why that's so looked at. But if it looks like the US is having to pull out, and the Israelis are starting to take over in Syria, that the US eye of Sauron is kind of swiveling in its tower, you know, and pointing now down towards South America.
Right. This little gal, this Swedish gal, I'm trying to remember her name, appeared at the World Economic Forum from Sweden and gave a speech to the assembly there about global warming, you know. And that was sort of interesting. But what they're doing is they're using this global warming or climate change to say that, you know, the economy will be impacted severely and things like that. So it was a predominant idea and discussion during the whole four-day conference forum, of what I could tell, over in Davos. And the word digital appeared every other word, yeah, yeah, too, you know.
On climate change, I mean, I think, you know, it's quite a controversial issue.
Right.
I think you have to be able to think clearly about it. It's almost as if anyone starts to critique, you know, this whole man-made global warming thing, they're branded at, you know, some sort of climate denier. No.
Right.
You've got to be able to have a discussion. We've got to have a proper discussion about it. Yes, of course, man is having an effect on the climate. I don't think there's any doubt whatsoever about that. And it's a completely separate argument to say we should be reducing car use. We should be reducing the use of fossil fuels. Yes, of course we should. The easiest way to do that is to reintroduce some of the good public transport networks that we've had in the future. The only trouble is those public transport networks have all been undermined and destroyed. I mean, basically, we should be providing virtually at cost public transport in all our major cities right across the Western world. I'm talking about tramways. I'm talking about buses. I'm talking about train networks. I'm talking about underground metro networks. All this stuff should be provided virtually at cost. That would really enable people to choose to have a car if they really need a car, but then also be able to choose to use public transport most of the time for most of the journeys. That would immensely, immensely reduce the pain and anguish of sitting in traffic jams. It would reduce the number of serious accidents on the roads, people being killed, children being run over. It would make an enormous difference to our lives, just generally, and the quality of life. I mean, we've had in various cities, I believe Seattle did this, they've just announced to do it, they're doing it in Luxembourg. They even tried to do it in London, would you believe, in the 1980s, was to make public transport free. I don't know if that is something that you've ever thought of doing in Texas.
We have buses all over the place here in Austin, Texas. Nobody rides them, though, Tony. And at one time, though, they made it free. And a lot of the homeless rode them, you know, and to get in and off out of the cold and everything. But our buses system here has been just built up into a major thing, but nobody's on them, you know. Nobody rides buses here.
I'll tell you what, you know? people will ride the buses. Yeah. There's two ways that they do it. And one is if you make it free.
Yeah.
The other one is if you also have a, you also have like a kind of conductor on the bus. That's what we used to call them here. Yeah. Someone that would go and just sort of be, look after the people on the bus for whatever reason.
Yeah.
Say it's a mother whose baby's screaming and crying, just to give her a hand. So not an elderly person that needs a little bit of help getting to their seat and from their seat, that kind of thing. So I think, you know, the idea of having two people staffing these buses is also really important. And if you've got to, and it's also, this is making work for people.
Yeah.
So the cost involves the fuel, involves the maintenance of the bus, involves paying a driver and a conductor, and surely, you know, our state officials or whatever and our local taxis can just pay for that. That will, I think, make life a hell of a lot easier. And that's the sort of thing that more enlightened parts of the world are already doing. I believe in Seattle that they've done it. I've never actually been to Seattle, so I've never seen it in action. But certainly, you know, more advanced countries like Luxembourg are choosing that. And also, for example, places like the Netherlands, Holland, that what they're doing is they're making sure that the public transport is extremely good and extremely reasonable price and extremely frequent. And almost everybody uses it, George, almost everyone.
Right. We just never had a bus riding crowd here in Austin. I mean, cars, automobiles are so inexpensive. You can buy something for $400 or $500 here, a car. You know what I mean? And so it should lend itself to driving, you know.
It will take you door to door. But, you know, what happens is in the bigger cities, what you're getting is you're just getting massive congestion and you're getting so much smog. I mean, you go, okay, we don't get it in London so much, but you go to Beijing, it's like basically the air is just hanging with poison.
God,
you've got to do
something
about this. You can't. This is the mad oil networks. This is really the legacy of the Rockefeller Empire, you know, making sure that they completely control transport. I mean, the Rockefellers were taking over the train networks and closing them down, the public transport networks, and secretly taking them over and closing them down. So, you know, that's what an enlightened future society will be like, is people will hop out of their homes, so long as they're not out living out in the boondocks somewhere, out in the middle of nowhere. You know, if you're in a suburban setting, you walk 5 minutes down the road, hop on a bus, get into work that way. It's much easier.
Right. We had some really good speakers on a lot of panels over there in Davos, and the Chinese are putting for a real nice
climate change.
Yeah, you know, it was all about climate change. That the Lagarde, you know what I mean, ended it like that. You know.
One of the most important counter arguments to climate change.
Yeah.
A lot of people don't look at this whole business of, Valentina Zarkova. Do you know about her? She's a Ukrainian professor. And she has brought up all sorts of interesting theories, which have proved experimentally, apparently, to be correct about sunspot activity.
Yeah. Okay.
So what we're talking here about is the what they call the grand solar minimum.
Okay.
Now that is where that occurs around about every 400 years. Where the sun goes through a 30-year cycle of very low sunspot activity, and that means very dramatic changes in the Earth's climate. So there's a difference in the solar winds, there's less actual energy coming from the sun, and so I think we could, you know, it's quite feasible, at least according to her, that we're due one of these grand solar minimums, 30 years of extreme weather conditions, starting around about 2023 and going on for about 30 years until the mid-2050s. So that is another thing, I think, which people who are getting very excited about climate change need to look very carefully at these sunspot cycles, and particularly just look up grand solar minimum, look up Valentina Zarkova, Zarkova, I believe is the way her professor's spelled, and you will see what she's done is she said, well, look, you know, this, yes, the climate could get worse, but it might not be anything to do with man-made global warming or climate change. It could also be severely affected, if not more affected, by this sunspot cycle. And I noticed as well that there's something, I think it's called the Parsons probe, that NASA had just sent up in August last year. Suddenly, NASA has taken a great interest in sunspots. Right. And I wonder if that's not because they aware that this grand solar minimum could be coming. And if the climate does go into a wobble in the next few years, it may man-made you know, CO2 in the atmosphere may well have something to do with it, but it could also be affected massively, of course, by the sun. And we've also seen one of the bits of evidence for this, George, is that they didn't really know much about the exact position of magnetic north 400 years ago in the 1600s when the Thames froze over, where we had the last one of these grand solar minimums. And they didn't know much about that, but that's been happening. You can literally go online, do an internet search, not necessarily Google, and you will find that the North Pole and the South Pole are starting to wander. They're going off the way that they're supposed to be going, and this is another sign that that something strange may be happening with the solar winds, with the Earth's magnetic field, that related to this grand solar minimum sunspot cycle.
Yeah, I've always heard from my physicist friends that the sun has about a 40% influence on our weather, warming or cooling. And that would go right along with what you're saying, see what I mean? And, of course, there's other influences. Cloud cover is real critical, too. And that's created by the El Nino and the La Nina. And then there's about there's a 13-year cycle, I think, out in the Pacific also, an oscillation, that has to do with cloud creation, you know. So, that's my NASA friend giving me that are doctors in meteorology. See what I mean? So there's more to it. It's not just all man created or an influence. That's for sure. What else is going on? Oh, that poison thing you were telling me about earlier. That poison gas.
It's another story this week. Really, yeah. It's taken a year pretty much for this information to come out to the public.
Okay.
But who was the first person on the scene? As Yulia Skripal and Sergei Skripal started feeling sick on a bench in Salisbury in Wiltshire in England. And the rest, of course, is history. We've had something like 40 expansions of diplomats from all over the European Union and other places as well because of this so-called poisoning. Which to me is just a psychological warfare operation. I don't believe that these two were poisoned. They've now, of course, disappeared. They were working under the auspices of MI6, being supervised by their handler, Pablo Miller, from MI6, who lived near Salisbury too, and who they met up with every week, or at least Sergei did. And the person who was the first on the scene, it turns out, is a woman called Colonel Alison McCourt. And Colonel Alison McCourt, there are great pictures of her. If you have a look online, you can see her stood outside Downing Street with six great big medals hanging off her chest. And it turns out that she's the most senior nurse anywhere in the British Army, and she just happens to be there at the same time as all this incident happens. I wonder if you think that's coincidence, George.
Well, I think it's sure, you know. Now that thing had holes in it, didn't it? I mean, that whole story had problems, you know, from the beginning.
Story is full of holes.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really the reporting of it which is so bad. Nobody really reporting that the biggest chemical weapons and biological weapons store in Europe, which really shouldn't even exist, is literally 10 minutes drive away from where this happened. Also, that Sergei Skripal had been discussing the possibility of returning to Russia, so this may have been some way of persuading him to stay here and not to go back to Russia. Also, that he was involved, this guy called Christopher Steele, with Orbis Business Intelligence, who were also involved with Skripal. And these are the people that helped prepare the dodgy Trump dossier in the run to the presidential elections. So what you've got here is a whole kind of private network of individual business interests connected to MI6. And, of course, MI6 love this. They call it the cutout because MI6 can be arranging all of this, just like the CIA, you know, helped arrange the assassination of John F. Kennedy. But if anyone is asking any questions, they hold their hands up and say, oh, nothing to do with us, Governor. And so this is the connection, really, is between the Skripal case and the attack on Donald Trump in the presidential elections. This is the deep state. And also, of course, Russiagate. they're connected with that too. So this is an anti-Russia campaign, and they're also connected, by the way, to something else called the Integrity Initiative, which was revealed a few weeks ago. Again, an anti-Russian propaganda outfit. Now, isn't that funny? The anti-Russian propaganda to do with Donald Trump, anti-Russian propaganda to do with the Integrity Initiative, and anti-Jeremy Corbyn, who is more friendly with Russia, is connected directly with the handlers, that is Christopher Steele and Pablo Miller, involved in the Skripal case. And who just happens to be on the scene as this whole incident unfolds, where these people get this deadly chemical on them, which doesn't kill them, amazingly, and then they just disappear off into the sunset and never to be seen again. It's the one connection that links them all. Pablo Miller, Christopher Steele, Orbis Business Intelligence. This is basically a little private psychological warfare operation run at arm's length by MI6 to discredit Russia. And I think anyone that takes any time to really look into this can see that the intelligence services are just running roughshod over international law, doing everything they can to cook up, harden the sides for a coming potential World War III. You know, let's have a go at the Russians time. But the thing is that they're not going to be able to deal with Putin in the same way as they dealt with Colonel Gaddafi or Saddam Hussein. Putin is a much more difficult character to deal with, and the Russians, well, they've been having a go at Russia, haven't they, ever since before Napoleon and before Adolf Hitler. And they still haven't managed to crack that particular nut, and I don't think they're going to do it this time either. But they may take millions of people down trying, George.
Someone said that if that was Novichok, that poisonous gas, they'd been dead and just quickly. So it wasn't that. You know what I mean?
Well, just that. I spoke to someone who's an expert on chemical weapons.
That's right.
And they said be at least 200 or 300 people dead.
Right. If it was really what they said it was.
It's incredibly dangerous stuff. Right. And you don't just have some sort of physical contact with it. You just need to be nearby. And so it's a miracle that Colonel Alison McCourt even survived.
Right.
I think what we're looking at here is control of the press, control of the media. Just one little tidbit, because I worked in Salisbury for the BBC for a year.
Okay.
1993. Is that the chief constable of Salisbury was very critical of the Tory party, and particularly of Edward Heath, the former prime minister, and named him as a paedophile.
Really? Oh, my God.
He lost his job. He was transferred. He was transferred a couple of months before the Skripal incident, right? Because this is East Wiltshire and Salisbury. That was his patch. He was transferred up to Cleveland. And the first day the new guy had in his new job was when this incident happened. So the new chief constable of Wiltshire was completely unprepared, didn't know any of his, officers and chains of command and everything. So he was all over the place. He couldn't really. And then we've just heard last week that Mike Veal has now been forced to resign from Cleveland Police. So he's been kicked out of the police service altogether. And that's what you get for telling the truth nowadays of being an honest policeman here in Britain. You just get booted out, and put on the dole.
Well, sir, boy, I tell you what, you've got such good insight over there, Tony. We really appreciate everything that you're covering tonight on this interview.
No, that's fine. If anyone wants to pick up on our program we did on Friday, you'll find that at thisweek.org.uk. I'm afraid it's, a little bit of a chore. You have to right-click on the file and download it, but then you can listen at home, in the car, anywhere you want. And I can assure you, you'll be entertained as well as informed, because we just simply, I mean, in fact, our guest, Ron Mandel, he's this New Yorker, he's a former professor of international relations. And he's a great, fascinating guy. Just as we were chatting before we went on the radio, he said, I never listen to the BBC. Never. Not anymore. Radio 4.
Man.
BBC Television News is a load of bunkum. You know what he said? He said one of the best news sources in the world right now is from Qatar. It's Al Jazeera. Al Jazeera English, he said, that's the news I like. And I've spent my life studying international relations. I can tell you that's the most balanced news in the world right now.
And even RT has some good programs at times, too. And that roughly is covering the yellow jackets, or, well, the yellow vest over there.
Well, you know what, George, RT has gone downhill since they stopped having me on 3-4 years ago. But, I mean, you can understand that they wanted to moderate things a little bit. They don't want a firebrand like me on there. After they went into Syria, that was basically when it all kind of changed at RT, and a lot of the people that had been on there, a bit more radical, Adrian Salbucci, another really good guy from Argentina who was on regularly.
Okay.
He hasn't been on since. You know, what they've done is they've toned RT down a bit. They're making it a little bit more, you know, snuggly and friendly to the Americans, which is absolutely fine. I mean, that's a very, very legitimate tactic. It's just, a pity I don't get a chance so often to, you know, to reach a bit of a wider audience with some of the insight that, you know, I've built up over the last, 30 years in journalism.
Yeah, I knew Salbucci. I've interviewed him way back years ago, but not lately. Well, thank you very much, Tony, and appreciate everything you're doing over there.
God bless, George.
Okay.
And here's to a safe 2019 for all of our audience, because it's looking like it might be a bit of a rocky road, this one.
Well, I agree with you, so let's wish everybody a good 2019. That was a good sentiment there, Tony. Thank you, man.
Cheers, George.
Cheers. Bye-bye. Good night.
God bless, George. Bye.
God bless you.